The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the award-winning website creation platform that helps you make the front page. With Getty Image integration and elegant templates, you can give your viewers the whole picture. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, can genetic screening help children perform better at school? Professor Robert Plomin says that testing children's genetics could one day flag up learning deficiencies and allow for earlier educational interventions. We speak to Robert about his findings, which also suggest that genetics play a major role in children's success in arts and science. Plus, the US completes its reconnaissance of the classical solar system with the flyby of Pluto. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Would true equality in education mean testing children's genetic code at the age of four so that any learning difficulties revealed can be accommodated right from the start of primary education? Robert Plomin is Professor of Behavioural Genetics at King's College London. He's the co-author with Catherine Asbury of G is for Genes, The Impact of Genetics on Education and Achievement. He joins us in the studio alongside The Guardian's science correspondent Hannah Devlin. Robert, can I ask you to start just by telling us how genetics might be able to tell us about our academic potential?
Let me just start with the basic question, which is why are children so different in how well they do at school? For example, how easily they learn to read. I mean, teachers, parents, everyone knows that some children find it very easy to learn to read. It would almost be difficult to stop them learning to read. Whereas other children take a lot of work to get them to read. You can get everyone to read, but some children take a lot more effort to do that. And we have assumed that in education, that that's all environmental. It has to do with what the parents did, how much they read to the children, that sort of thing, or the schools. So when we have a crisis every few years when PISA results come out and we think kids in England aren't doing so well, people panic and they blame the teachers, blame the schools, blame the parents, and blame the children for not being well motivated. Well, that may be true, but what about the possibility that some of the differences are due to genetic differences, DNA differences between the children? So that's what we're trying to study, is the extent to which genetics is important, and it isn't all environmental. And, you know, the bottom line is genetics is incredibly important. It's so much more important than anyone ever thought. And these areas of, we call them cognitive abilities, cognitive skills like learning to read and mathematics and verbal ability, these are some of the most heritable things around, which means that the differences between children are substantially due to DNA differences between the children. And it's really important to emphasize the word differences. So you asked about potential. Well, potential isn't right. Potential implies an individual's potential. But we're not talking about one individual. We're not saying that genetics gives the children 50% of their ability to learn to read and the other 50% is the environment. We're talking about differences between children. So if you give children, say like Michael Gove's phonic screening test at 7 years of age, children differ a lot on that. It used to be thought that's all due to how good the teachers are teaching the children. But we know in my studies that that is the single most heritable test around. And so that's why we need to ask about genetics. Because you make big mistakes if you assume it's all environmental and you blame the teachers, the schools, and the parents.
How do you actually tease out the genetic component? How big a role genetics plays in these things? What do you do?
Yeah, well, what's really exciting now is you do DNA research, and that's what's happening big time. And that's why it's important we have these discussions now, because once we identify some of the genes responsible for the genetic influence, it takes us to a new level of application. And perhaps scary to people or whatever, but we need to discuss these issues now before it happens, because it will be happening. Up until now, though, for the last century, there have been methods like the twin method, which is what I've used, which compares identical and non-identical twins. So about 1% of all births are twins. 1/3 of those are identical twins. They're called monozygotic because they're a single fertilized egg. And they're actually more clones than a clone, because these clones, they're their DNA is the same, but they're brought up in the same womb and in the same family. Whereas if you or I had a clone, it would be brought up in a different mother in a different decade. So by comparing the similarity of identical and non-identical twins, we're able to estimate genetic influence. And there's a lot of statistical techniques involved here, but the essence of it is just to say, if individual differences, say in performance on the phonics screening test, show genetic influence, you'd have to predict that identical twins, who are genetically identical, will be more similar than non-identical twins. And that's actually what you find big time. Identical twins are almost twice as similar as non-identical twins. There are other methods as well, like the adoption method. But these methods are beginning to be confirmed with these new DNA studies as well.
Can you give us some figures just so people have an idea of the numbers we're talking about? Mm-hmm. So for variants in math results, science results, or arts, of these kind of achievements, how much is down to genetics?
Well, variance is a statistic that describes the differences between individuals. And it's variance is distributed in this bell-shaped normal curve where most people are in the middle, and as you get to either extreme, there are fewer and fewer people. And we can talk about dividing that variance up into genetic and environmental components. So for height, for example, I think most people would recognize individual differences are highly heritable. Not 100% heritable, but maybe 80, 90% heritable. So that's 90% of the differences between people are due to DNA differences. Now, more surprising, weight, how heritable is that? Well, all of these studies converge on a conclusion of about 70%, 60, 70% heritable, which really surprises people because they think, you know, well, you can just diet or whatever. But it's describing individual differences as they exist in a population. And it's not saying, although weight is highly heritable, it doesn't mean you can't do anything about it. If we get locked in this room and we can't eat for a week, we're all going to lose weight, no question about it. But we differ in weight. When we go out and we start eating again, I'm going to pig out, you aren't, and I'll put that weight right back on again. And so in that context, it's interesting to think about educational achievement. And what we're most surprised by is even in the early school years, the variance in educational achievement on national curriculum scores, for example, about 60% of those differences are due to genetic differences. So that's less than the 80, 90% for height, less than the 70% for weight, but it's higher than for most traits that we study, even psychiatric disorders and that sort of thing. So it accounts for a lot. And what amazed me is it accounts for as much of the variance in the early school years as it does in the middle school years, GCSEs, and A-levels.
It sounds as if this doesn't mean that genetics is more important than school or family environment, or it's not that genetics is 60% of whether you are good at something or not. Is that right?
That's right. It's of the differences among children. And usually in education, people talk about means, averages. So, for example, when we take league tables for schools, you know, schools differ in the performance, average performance of the children. But what we need to ask as a parent is, how big is that effect? You know, we spend a lot of money assuming that this means a lot, these league table differences. But, you know, it's a 5% difference, but on what scale? How much of the variance in children's performance can be explained by schools? And the answer is a lot less than 20% of the variance. So as a parent, you've got to know that, yes, schools make a difference, but not much in terms of educational achievement when you think of genetics accounting for 60% of the variance, of the differences in children's performance. So the way of thinking about this is if you look not just at the means across schools, which is what league tables do, but you add the variance to that, what you find is that 80, 90% of the variance overlaps. What that means is that the best schools will have children who perform less well than some of the best students in the less good schools. There's a great deal of overlap in these distributions. And so as a parent, you know, you've got to think about that. It's not just the means, it's the variance, and that's what we call effect size. Not just are these significant differences statistically, but how big are these differences?
I think a lot of parents would be really interested to hear that, Robert. So I wonder if you think that people are too obsessed with what school they should send their child to, or maybe they're rightly concerned because that's one of the things they can actually control, whereas your genetics, you're stuck with that.
Yeah, I think if parents are sending their children, you know, worrying about private schooling, and what do they say, £300,000 if you start off early in life, I can't believe that it's worthwhile if you're doing it for educational achievement differences. But I think they're not. I think people are doing it because they want their child to be in an atmosphere that, you know, is comfortable, that has the resources for art. And there's lots of other reasons, and that's fine. But I think it is important for people to know that schools don't make that much of a difference. The 20% includes everything to do with schools. It just has to do with school X versus school Y. And as we well know, we don't have selection, but we have selection by house price. And what goes into house prices is socioeconomic status of parents, and that's highly correlated with parents' educational level, which is highly heritable. So this is like saying, if you count everything that differs between schools, we're talking about 20% of the variance, in contrast to the 60% due to DNA differences. But that the 20% is, in my view, much less, like more like 10% at most. I don't want to pit nature versus nurture, but I think you've got to get people's attention to say 60% of the variance. I mean, we can't begin to touch that, you know, with anything else, including schools.
Robert, we've been talking about genetic variants, but do we know which actual genes we're talking about? Or is this just that we can say how much of the differences for children are generally genetic?
Well, when we say genetic, we mean DNA differences ultimately. But the question you're asking is, to what extent have we identified the genes that account for these genetic differences, these DNA differences? And the answer is not much, but it's beginning to happen, and it's happening more in education and cognition than most other areas. This is called the missing heritability problem. We know that many things throughout the life sciences, medical diseases, show a strong genetic influence, but it's been hard to find the specific DNA differences that account for that. And that's probably because there are many, many genes, thousands of genes of very small effect. So it isn't like the gene for math ability or something like that. We're talking about thousands of genes of small effect, which means it's difficult to identify them. And that's why, in a way, these twin and adoption studies are becoming more valuable, because they get at the bottom line of genetic influence. If these things weren't heritable, we would say, well, forget trying to find genes for them.
Do we even have a rough idea of what the genes might do? I mean, just from looking at which things are most heritable, is it things like maths ability, or are these more general traits like how willing a person is, a student is, to please the teacher, or how hardworking they are?
That's a really good question, because I would have thought that some things like math might be more heritable, but our assumptions about what is or is not more heritable are usually very wrong. There's some good examples in the medical area. You think Parkinson's, that's the brain, that's probably heritable. It's one of the common medical disorders that's not heritable at all. And you take something like ulcers, which people, that's not heritable, that's the most heritable. So our assumptions about what is and isn't heritable aren't very good. And in this case, they're not very good either in case of math or humanities, because we've got a paper coming out next month on that topic for GCSEs. And what we show is that everything is equally heritable, about 60%. That includes humanities as well as STEM subjects. There's a little evidence, you know, for a little bit more heritability for, say, math in STEM as compared to humanities, but there's not much in it, and it's not a significant difference. So the more striking finding is how all of these things are heritable.
But Robert, if it is hundreds, thousands of genes that are at play here, that are the ones responsible for these differences in childhood achievements, doesn't that really cause problems for any prospect of screening children for their abilities at a really early age? And perhaps even the genes may not be consistent. They may be, you know, a certain bunch of genes in one group. They may be slightly different genes in another group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely right, that it's going to be difficult throughout the life sciences to actually get DNA predictors of things, but this is where all the research is going, and the best minds in biology are addressing this issue, and there are increasing successes in that line. I can tell you about some of the advances there and the strategies that are used, but I'm convinced it is happening. We can explain 1 or 2% of the variants right now. And that's just in the first sort of tries. Now, that's a lot less than what people had expected. But coming to grips with the idea that these are DNA differences, they're in the genome, but they're harder to find because there's so many and they're small in effect. But there are ways of kind of doing that, to pool, not to look for one gene or another gene, but to look for lots of genes at the same time. This polygenic approach is where most of this research is going. So I do think that we will have identified genes that account for a few percent of the variance in a couple of years. And that's actually better than we can do predicting from most other things anyway. And the neat thing about DNA prediction is you can predict from early in life. This is why I've been in this racket for 20 years, is because I'd like to be able to find genes so that you could predict problems early, because all of science medicine now is concerned with prediction and prevention rather than waiting until there are problems and trying to cure the problems, because we're not so good at that. You think of obesity, alcoholism, schizophrenia. The idea is if we could predict and then develop interventions to prevent, it has to be more cost-effective economically, societally, and personally.
Isn't it just going to be more effective, though, to see how a child is doing with a book in their hand at 4 years old, to see whether they can say a particular word or whether they can even draw a particular geometrical shape or something, because then you are looking at that real child in their environment and it's the culmination of all their genes giving rise to their behavior, mm-hmm. rather than what you're talking about, which is at the moment trying to look for genes that account for a tiny proportion of this effect and only the genetic mm-hmm. aspect.
Well, actually, we're looking for genes that account for all the genetic effects. Right now, we've only found a few percent. I think that will get better, but the big question is how much better? You know, will it account for half of the genetic influence? You know, we don't know yet. But that's what I want to do, because that leads to much greater precision in our research and that sort of thing, even if it doesn't end up having the clinical application that you're talking about. So it could lead to differential diagnosis. These children have this set of genes, and that suggests that sort of problem that you don't see. I mean, reading is a very complex development, and problems in reading could probably come from many different areas. And it might be that different causes of reading disability will profit more from different sorts of interventions. So that differential diagnosis idea is nonetheless important. And it's partly what's driving the current attempt to have children start school earlier. It's currently in the news, you know, having primary schools go down to two-year-olds, for example. But the problem is, like with reading, of course, you don't get any sort of reading at 3 or 4, really, to speak of. It's not predictive of later reading. But you could do what you're talking about, because almost all children who have reading problems have earlier language problems. Not all children with earlier language problems go on to reading problems, so that's a bit of an issue. The other side of it is an issue of precision. These interventions aren't cheap little tricks. Most of what we know from education is you have a child who has trouble learning to read. It really takes a lot of work. There isn't some, you know, there's all these gimmicks out there in education that are not proven at all, but people buy into them, like balance boards, these cockamamie theories, you know, and yet people buy into it because they want a silver bullet, you know, that's just going to fix these things. I think it's going to take a lot of work, and a lot of work means a lot of money, and that probably means you can't do it for everyone. Because the other argument I got is, well, why don't you just do all this stuff, this good stuff for everybody? Well, if we could, it would probably be a good idea, although you might wonder about how early we want the stress of education the way it is now, you know, pushing kids so hard. I'm not sure that's a good thing. It's not my area, but I've had children, and I think in my case, for my children, it wouldn't have been such a good thing.
I think this really brings us on to this bigger point of what we want from education and what the point of school is. And I'm really interested in how genetics fits in with that. Yeah. Just coming back to that example you gave earlier about if you heritability of weight, and if you put everyone in a room and controlled exactly what they ate, everyone would lose weight. Mm-hmm. With school, you could say the same thing, that if your ultimate goal was to get everyone up to a common level, you could make that the focus, and then you'd see less genetic influence in our results. Is that the way we should be going, or do you have views on how these results should inform what we do with schools?
Yeah, well, I think that's the key implication of this research. That is, if you get people to recognize that genetic differences are important, then you say, well, okay, what difference does it make in terms of school? And the biggest implication for me is that heritability is an index of equality. And the reason for that is if schools differ because children have different access to educational resources, that sort of thing, those are environmental differences. School differences are environmental differences. So if you got rid of those environmental differences, you're still left with the genetic differences. So that proportionately, the genetic differences, heritability, would account for more of the differences you see, because you're not going to get rid of those differences. And so you could say, well, then people say, just what you were saying, that does that mean you just give up, you know, because it's genetic differences? It doesn't at all. It depends on your values. If you had, like, some right-wing values, you could say, well, it's more economical for society if we just educate the best and forget the rest. But I think if you think in a larger framework, society needs, it's based, its success depends on its intellectual capital, which isn't just the people who invent Google and calculus. It depends on a broader infrastructure of intellectual capital. So you need to educate many more people, increasingly so, with our technological world. If you had left-wing values, you could do exactly what you were saying. You could, it's called the Finnish model in a way, where you just say, we define minimal levels of literacy and numeracy in our society in order to participate in our technological society. And we do whatever it takes to bring everybody up to that level. I have one grandson who was having a great deal of difficulty learning to read, and he was going to be taken out of mainstream school. His parents and we put in incredible amounts of energy, and the kid is reading, you know, reasonably well now. Now, would that mean, though, that there's no heritability? I don't think so. It usually, when you provide even a you know, like you bring everybody up from the bottom, it doesn't mean that everyone else has fallen to that level. Usually when you introduce resources, you increase the genetic differences because children take advantage of opportunities differentially based on their genetic influences. So that was the first point you made. The second, the larger issue, I think, is that a genetic view of education suggests a different model of education. The old model is sort of a passive model of instruction. Instruction comes from the Latin, which is instruere, which means to shove it in. And that's the way it was. You have a curriculum, you shove it in kids' heads, and you pump out these citizens who have been educated. But it's a real passive model, and it doesn't recognize that children differ genetically. The model that I think a genetic view suggests is an active model, which in genetics we call genotype-environment correlation. It's the idea that children create and modify and select environments that are correlated with their genetic propensities, so that the same classroom isn't the same classroom. Some children can take huge advantage of it, and others don't. And that's the idea of education. I think as parents and teachers, we need to give our children opportunities to see what they like to do and what they're good at, and to draw it out. That's educare, is to lead out, to draw out. And so I think that's a much better model of education, and it favors the current position on personalized learning and choice and that sort of thing. So it's easy to talk in these highfalutin sort of words, but I think it is a really different way of thinking about parenting as well as education, that we're sort of like resource managers. And I did say you got to find out what children like to do as well as what they're good at, because increasingly, and this is sort of what you were getting at, is it more motivational in a way? Genetics doesn't necessarily mean hardwired neural differences in brains. I think increasingly I find it has to do with appetite as well as aptitude. And that could be because it's kind of circular. You like to do what you're good at. It kind of is in a feedback loop. And that's good. I think GE correlation is a good thing. You should allow children to kind of seek out the things that they're good at. That's a very broad level of implications, but I do think it's an important one. And sometimes these general principles have a bigger impact than, you know, a very specific policy.
Can behavioral genetics help education now? Or is it really a case for having to understand what the genes are and then that screening becoming possible in, what, 10, 20 years or something?
Yeah, well, when we've identified the genes, it certainly will raise this to a whole new level, which is good for us to talk about it now, because in my view, there's so much work going on in the area of identifying genes for everything in the life sciences, including cognitive abilities and educational achievement, that I think it's going to happen, and it's starting to happen. However, right now, I think that these implications are pretty big in a way. For example, I mean, all you read about in newspapers is when schools are failing, it's all viewed from an environmental point of view. You know, you think about it from a genetics point of view, the children who aren't performing well, you might want to get more credit there. I mean, because it's not that all children are the same. And schools differ a lot by their intake. We talked about added value. We could talk about that. That doesn't work either. That doesn't make it purely environmental. So our whole way of thinking about education is kind of screwed up because we don't take genetics seriously. Just one specific example. Michael Gove introduced the phonics screening test for all 600,000 7-year-olds every year. It was thought because that was going to be an index of how well those teachers are getting on board with the new phonics, which is just the old phonics. You know, it's just that things keep going around like that. We had used that test in our studies, our twin studies in the UK with 7,000 pairs of twins. And we find that test is the most heritable test of any test we give. So it doesn't mean it was, you know, it's a bad test at all, but it was just assumed that how well children do in phonics at 7 is totally due to how much phonics the teachers teach. And that just isn't the case. So I know what you're saying is that these are kind of general implications, and until we actually have the genes and can predict, our implications are going to be limited to that general level. But I do think it's a big change in education, because right now, if you look at teacher books, you know, books that teachers take during training, you won't find anything about genetics. And yet this is the area where there's more heritable influence than any other area in the behavioral sciences. So there is this kind of Alice in Wonderland feeling to me. And I do think, you know, we did a survey of teachers and parents of young children. They will tell you they believe that genetic differences are very important. I think you cannot help, but when you teach a classroom of 30 children, it hits you over the head how different these children are and how easily they learn. I guess you could say, well, it's due to the parenting, for example. But then you come to realize two children in the same family differ. How do you explain that? Well, genetics explains it because they're only 50% similar genetically unless they're identical twins. So I do believe these are important implications for education. And maybe if we get the genetics thing going in education, by the time we have the genes, we'll be able to have more intelligent discussions about how to use them to help children in education.
If you get to the point where a genetic screening is possible for children, isn't there a risk that you have a detrimental effect on some of the children? Because let's say that you find a bunch of kids and their genetic profile suggests that they're going to struggle with mathematics. It may be that a bunch of those kids are actually doing fine because they're in an environment that allows them to do fine, okay? Because you're only measuring half of the issue, the nature-nurture issue, right? You're just measuring the genetics. But you then essentially pigeonhole them as being kids who need better mathematical, better maths coaching, if you like. And isn't there a danger that becomes self-fulfilling, that they realize they've been putting the bottom set, say, for maths, mm-hmm. even though they were doing fine, but their genetics says they shouldn't be? And I'm wondering if you can cause problems with that you almost reinforce the genetic determinism issue.
Yeah, well, the labeling issue is something people do bring up, and I'm a cheerleader for this sort of thing because I would say, you know, it gives us a chance to identify children early before they're put into sets. I mean, you talk about self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, these kids, you might call them Robins and whatever, but children know very quickly, you know, if they're in the bottom set as well. So that goes on anyway, but it doesn't go on before school. And so if you could predict earlier and intervene earlier, I think you could circumvent some of those problems. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, there's a lot of doom-mongering about genetics, but I think it's one of the most exciting things around to be able to, say, predict a child who's particularly good at math, for example, who you might not know it because, you know, they come from a background where, you know, their verbal skills aren't sufficient and they don't maybe have the confidence to do it. So I think I'm going to stay a cheerleader just to kind of be an antidote to the so many doom mongers around about this. But we do need to discuss these issues, and it's good to discuss them now before we have the DNA chips. I should say the DNA chips are here. If you go online, there are, you know, disreputable companies who are taking genes that have been identified in one study or another and saying, you know, we can predict that whether your child will be good at school or not. And it's totally wrong. They don't have the evidence for it yet. But it is happening. You know, there's a lawsuit in the United States about there was a gene for reading disabilities quite a few years ago. And people said, my child has that form of the gene. Therefore, my child is genetically disabled. Therefore, my child gets the $30,000 a year that you get for special tutoring. You know, it was thrown out because But that, you know, those are the sorts of issues that will come up. But I take comfort in the fact that these issues are all going to come up in the medical sphere first, not just for the thousands of single gene disorders that are very rare, but for the big killers, you know, the obesities and diabetes and that sort of thing. And it's just the same issues. We've identified some of the genes, quite a few more for those complex traits than for reading disability and math disability. But that's because the amount of research money that's gone into it is a hundredfold greater. So I think, though, that the techniques that have been developed and the concerns that have been raised about it, you know, like in the case of medical illnesses, insurance issues, for example. But in general, I think people are coming down to saying, well, if you can predict and say you specifically, not just the family risk, but you specifically are at great risk for diabetes, and if you put on weight and you do other lifestyle sorts of things, you're going to have trouble, whereas maybe your brother won't because your brother didn't happen to get that combination of genes. So I think it will do a lot of good, and we have to, of course, be careful and not complacent about the possible damage that will occur.
It's an interesting comparison with the medical sphere because doctors are always looking out for the latest scientific idea and the latest genes that they might be able to screen for. I'm interested in how good teachers and politicians are when you speak to them at getting on board with some of these new scientific ideas around education. And I mean, there's other things coming out as well in neuroscience about how we learn. Are schools and teachers generally good at taking on these new things, or are they more resistant?
It's abysmal. I mean, when I came 20 years ago, you couldn't even talk about genetics in an educational audience. It just was forbidden. It was a taboo subject. So I think things have changed. At least you can go to conferences. I went to the Times Education Festival a few weeks ago and have a symposium on genetics in education with some of the top education people. And it's not just knee-jerk sort of rejection now. People are starting to talk about it. But I've realized, I gave a series of lectures at the Department for Education, and I've come to realize it's ignorance, really. It's not antipathy as much as ignorance. And that's probably easier to deal with, but it's kind of scary. And I've also realized it's not a problem with genetics. It's a problem with evidence. So 30 years ago, medicine wasn't particularly evidence-based. Now it's totally evidence-based, right? You can't introduce anything unless you've done randomized controlled trials. I think education fundamentally is not concerned about evidence. It's not evidence-based. What program has been rolled out where they've actually tested it, as you would do in medicine? We spend as much money on education as we do on the NHS almost in most developed countries. Yet there is no sense. It's like I used to hear from doctors 30 years ago, well, you may say that's what you researchers say, but I know from my vast clinical experience that, you know, the way I've been doing it, that's the way to do it. You can't say that now in medicine. So I think we ought to hold educationists to the same standard as medicine, because you have as much chance of damaging children with these cockamamie things, you know, gimmicks that come out, for example, always changing the programs. We always, with no evidence, you know, it's just a smokescreen. You do this and then you don't test it, really, but you go off and do this, and then you do that, and it's really abysmal. I mean, it's appalling that people don't accept evidence as the ultimate arbiter of whether things work or not.
So you're saying we'll look back and see all these educational fads like phonics and visual learning or what have you in the same way that we see leeches or something in medicine today?
Yeah, I absolutely do. I mean, you know, and you're right to do that. You know, you until people give you the evidence that something works, you know, you shouldn't accept it. So no, I feel very strongly that I'm wasting my breath talking about genetics when people don't accept evidence per se.
So, Robert, if genetics is explaining a large part of the differences that we see between pupils, does that mean that when you look at on an international scale, if you look at the differences in PISA results, say, across different countries, that, say, Singaporean children are better adapted genetically to studying maths?
Well, the PISA results that you read about every few years are like the school league tables. The school league tables I talked about before are mean differences between schools. So it's the average difference in performance between schools. PISA results are between country differences. I said that schools account for less than 20% of the variance, of the differences in children's performance. Not nothing, but it is 80% short of 100%, and genes account for 60%. So just, you know, just saying, that's a big difference. But PISA results in country differences. People look at those means, they say, oh God, England's only in the middle. And you got to say, always, what's the effect size here? How big are these differences? And the answer is they're incredibly small. They account for about 1% of the variance. We're getting all excited about nothing. If you look at the overlap in terms of the range of individual differences, they're incredibly tiny. The overlap between countries is 90%, something like that. So these are trivial differences. And yet we get all bent out of shape about them. They're statistically significant because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, so that the tiniest difference is significant. But the larger issue here is, even if there were mean differences, it's an important point that the causes of mean differences, like you mentioned earlier, between boys and girls, well, the causes of mean differences aren't necessarily related to the causes of individual differences, so that the mean difference between boys and girls could be all environmental, for example, even though individual differences for boys and for girls are very substantially due to genetic differences. So you could see where that could come about. I mean, maybe girls are just disadvantaged, for example. They experience a prejudice that boys don't. So there would be a mean environmental cause of the difference that has very little to do with the individual differences. So it does make an important point. But these are all about, these issues are about mean differences, league tables and PISA results. Behavioral genetics is about individual differences and the causes of individual differences. And what's interesting in the national context is that you could get different results in different countries, and not necessarily because of genetic differences between the countries. It seems to me more likely it could be environmental. So there's an interesting emerging finding. This hasn't been proven yet, but a few studies have suggested it, that heritability of educational achievement in the United States is less than in the UK and Western Europe. And, you know, why could that be? I mean, if it were true, why could that be? And people are excited about it because they think European countries tend to have national curricula. You could argue about how well we actually impose a national curriculum, but it's there, and, you know, it's something people can't ignore. Whereas in the United States, 20 years ago, they became completely decentralized. Everybody do your own thing. And that creates a lot of environmental variability from district to district. So it's reasonable to think that the environmental differences, bad differences, you know, differences in quality of education, are accounting for more of the differences in children's educational performance in the U.S. than in the U.K. If people get all of this, they'll understand why I say that heritability is an index of equality. Because if you could get rid of all the environmental inequalities, you'd be left with the DNA differences, and a trait should be 100% heritable.
Robert Plomin there. And G is for Genes, the Impact of Genetics on Education and Achievement, by Catherine Asbury and Robert Plomin, is published by Wiley & Sons.
When you want the whole picture, you choose The Guardian. When you want to create your own, you choose Squarespace, the all-in-one website building platform that lets you buy domains, create your own logo, and more. Whatever you want to showcase, Squarespace gives you simple yet powerful tools and elegant designs to make any idea brilliant. Create your own picture at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Ian, let's take a look at science news this week. The big story has been Pluto and the New Horizons mission, which has just gone past Pluto, doing the first close flyby. What have we learned so far from the mission?
Well, first of all, we learned that New Horizons survived the flyby, because there was this 1 in 10,000 chance that as the spacecraft went through the plane of Pluto and its moons, that it was going to hit some dust, because they expect it to be a bit of a dusty environment. They can't see any that was going to look potentially problematic, but what you'd expect is these little moons, Pluto's got five moons, and those little moons will get meteorites banging into them over time. They'll shed up dust, and that will end up gathering around Pluto. So there was this tiny chance that coming in at 14 kilometres a second, New Horizons is going to smash into one of those grains and be destroyed. We know it survived because it sent a signal back to say all was well. Now, what we've learnt about it from the imagery so far is that First thing was more from other measurements suggesting that Pluto's actually bigger than they thought. Not by much, but it's about 1,500 miles across, which makes it officially the largest object in the Kuiper Belt, or at least beyond Neptune that's known of, within our solar system at least. And they learned also that the atmosphere of Pluto extends a lot more than they expected it to. Now, you might wonder why Pluto's really got an atmosphere. Well, as it comes around the sun, when it gets nearer to the sun, it heats up and you've got a lot of ice on Pluto. So you end up with an atmosphere coming up from the frozen methane and the frozen nitrogen and so on the surface. And it retains the atmosphere as it goes back out on the sort of furthest distances of its orbit. That atmosphere extends about seven times of the radius of Pluto beyond the surface. So it's got a very thin but a very sort of extensive atmosphere, if you like, which was a new result too. I think what interested me most was that the surface of Pluto is actually pretty smooth. If you look at the largest of its five moons, Charon, these objects are so sort of similar in mass, if you like, that they don't, the moon doesn't sort of fly around Pluto. They actually both rotate around a point in between them. Now, the surface of Charon is pretty well battered, but if you look at Pluto, it's a lot smoother. So they think that either there's some geological processes going on there or something happening with the atmosphere, with the climate, that's sort of continuously modifying the surface and really erasing a lot of those craters and impacts that must be happening and making it a bit of a smoother, sort of younger looking body than it is.
So we've taken nearly 10 years to get to Pluto, and the flyby's been and gone within the space of an evening. Where's the mission going to next, and what are the big things that we're hoping to observe from now on?
So New Horizons has this nuclear generator on board that's powered by plutonium appropriately, and it's going to give it energy to survive until about 2020, 2030. So this spaceship has got a lot of lifetime in it yet. Now, where's it going to go? That's still to be decided, but they're out in the Kuiper Belt now. They've seen Pluto. They've got their first images of Pluto. It has to go somewhere else, and there are a number of other objects that they would like to go and see, but which ones they'll go and see first and in which order, that's still to be decided. We should hopefully find out pretty soon, but at the moment that's still really being worked out.
So does that mean they're still intervening and deciding where it's going and controlling the direction of the spacecraft from all this distance?
Yeah, that's right. Even though New Horizons is 3 billion miles away from Earth, they can still send signals to it. It takes a long time for them to get there, even at the speed of light. A signal sent from Earth with some commands on it to New Horizons will take about 4.5 hours to get there. But you can still send those signals, and you can instruct it to fire its hydrazine thrusters, basically. It has hydrazine thrusters on board that you only need to give a little nudge here and there to make it send it off on a trajectory towards whichever Kuiper Belt object you want to look at next. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to Robert Plowin and Hannah Devlin. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.